You are, and it's great to be here, sort of guiding you through the weekend. Coming up in a moment is Dr. Roger Lear. Now, I've known Dr. Lear for years. He wrote a book, this was some time ago now, called The Alien and the Scalpel. And that's because that's what he does. He is said to be one of the world's most important leaders in physical evidence research involving the field of ufology. Now, if ufology can use anything, it certainly is physical evidence. He and his surgical team have performed 9 surgeries now on alleged alien abductees. This has resulted in the removal of 10 separate and distinct objects suspected of being alien implants. These objects have been scientifically investigated in some of the most prestigious laboratories in the world, have found all of it rather baffling. In fact, some comparisons have been made to meteorite samples. Now, that's very interesting because if you would imagine anything taken from the body of a human being to have an alien origin, that it would come back and look like things that we find from meteorites would make all the sense in the world. And the odds of it coming back that way would be almost impossible, wouldn't they? You take it out of a human being and the origin is, well, like that of a meteorite. What are the odds? Dr. Lear anticipates performing more surgeries in the future and will investigate the physiological and biological aspects of the abduction phenomenon. He's also formed a nonprofit organization for that specific purpose called ANS Research, Inc. Now, there's a little typo there, so I hope that's correct. He really is quite a guy, the only one doing, as far as I know, what he does. In a moment, Dr. Lear. Dr. Roger Lear, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you again, Art, all the way from the Philippines.
Yes, indeed. Let's see, when did we do our last program? It's been a while, hasn't it?
Oh, gosh, it has. Yes, I've done, I think, a couple with George in your absence. But you were so kind to me to make the wonderful statement that you did about the Brazil case when I wrote the book UFO Crash in Brazil.
Yes.
Published on the back of the book. A lot of good comments on that.
Oh, well, good. Good. Through all this, are you still actively practicing medicine?
Unfortunately, yes. I have a daughter that's 15. So we have to continue to crank in the bucks so I can pay for her times now and in the future.
Well, I see. Okay. So you spend, is it like a 5-day-a-week deal for you or more?
Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, off on Wednesday and weekends. But the mere fact of being off doesn't really mean much because between the research, the implant surgeries, other investigations in the UFO field, and an occasional time spent trying to restore an old 1948 Dodge, I keep pretty busy.
That's a lot on anybody's platter, and so it's a wonder that you find any time at all to do research. In fact, I'd kind of be interested, remind me, if we never talked about this, what in the world got you started in ufology? After all, you're a podiatrist, right?
That's correct.
So it's a long, long way from the foot to, you know, the object in the sky or the implant in the ear.
A long way to Tipperary, exactly. Yes. Most of my things in my life have been sort of one synchronicity upon the other. Years ago when I was quite young, maybe 11 or 12, I have a distinct recollection of my father bringing the San Francisco Examiner into the kitchen and reading the headline to my mother that said, U.S. Army Air Force captures flying saucer. And then he went on a long dissertation about how, see, I told you, you know, we can't be the only intelligent living beings in this vast universe. And I stood there listening to it. Now, how do I remember it was the San Francisco Examiner? Well, quite simple, because it was the only paper that he ever took, and I loved the comics. So that's how.
Boy, that was some headline. Say it again. U.S. Army?
U.S. Army Air Force captures flying saucer.
Huh. And that stood for how long until it became sort of a little piece of aluminum?
Well, it was only about a day. And
still, that must have been some one day. I mean, for one day, the major papers across the United States virtually said that we had a spaceship.
Right. Not only the United States, but around the world.
But around the world. So I wonder what that day was like when people genuinely, for at least one day, thought we had captured an alien craft.
Well, you can just imagine. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a little back page article.
No. It was front page stuff. So what was it like? Can you recall it all?
Well, there was a lot of silence. I mean, I remember the adults talking about it. It was, a major thing in lives at that time. 1947 was kind of a strange time because we had come out of the war.
Right.
The war machine was cranking down. You still couldn't get tires. There was still ration stickers on the windshield. You had to go to a special place even to get the kind of meat that you wanted to. So, the society wasn't, anywhere near like it was now. So people were, I believe, in a state of shock. But my father was a businessman. He was a very simple person. And he had a very simple way of thinking. In other words, if you were a plumber, then everything that there was to know about plumbing, you better know. So when the next, headline came in that it wasn't a saucer, but it was a balloon, he was just really bent out of shape. I mean, he said, you mean to say, and I remember this too, he told my mother, do you mean to say that the U.S. Army Air Force can't tell the difference between a saucer and a balloon?
Same thing they say today when we talk about that subject.
Exactly. But he put it in very, simple terms.
Sure. But for one day, the world thought that we actually had that. And it sure would be fun to go back and, get some kind of take on what people were talking about and what they thought and whether they were thinking, gee, is this the beginning of an invasion? Are we about to have another war? Or just exactly what people thought? It would be interesting to know. If that happened today, can you imagine if that occurred today?
Oh, gosh. I don't know what to say. If it happened today, I usually, when I give my presentations about the world, I get asked a lot, well, you think if this happened today, Dr. Lear, that people would go run and hide in the hills? And I usually say, well, if it happened in Los Angeles on rush hour, let's say a big, giant, 3-football-sized craft landed on the middle of the freeway in the rush hour, would there be a panic? And I say, well, yeah, there'd be a panic. People would be on their cell phones calling Caltrans to get it moved so they could get home.
That's probably exactly right. People in L.A. would just be bent out of shape at the traffic situation. I'm probably
that would be the extent of the panic. I mean, when you drive down the street and you see bumper stickers of gray aliens on the back of the bumpers and the kids are running around wearing T-shirts with a typical gray face on it and the History Channel and the Sci-Fi Channel and Discovery Channel and all the rest of them are continuously broadcasting things about UFOs and UFO documentaries and all subjects of the field day in and day out. And then you talk to the kids, you know, like my daughter, who has really no particular interest in this subject, but because she looks at it like, hey, the grass is growing on the lawn. I mean, what's the big deal? Oh, well, of course, you know, we can't be the only, you know, living intelligent creatures in this universe. So
perhaps the next generation doctor really would take it well. I mean, just hardly even blinking.
Oh, yes, I'm sure they will. It's a long cry from Orson Welles.
Well, you've chosen to enter a particularly controversial aspect of ufology, and that is there are people who believe that they have been abducted and that they have been implanted with some sort of device. Actually, you could tell me more about it than I could certainly make. Sit here and make statements. What do most people who believe they have been abducted think that their implant is doing? Is it some sort of monitoring device or what?
Well, if they have any thoughts as to why it's there at all, most of them think it's yes, it's some kind of monitoring device or controlling device, but that's probably not what it is at all. You know, human logic may not be exactly the same as logic from, let's say, intelligences from elsewhere that may be thousands or millions of years older than we are. So we can only look at things in terms of human logic. And I've had the occasion to be in 42 countries in the last 7 years. Excuse me. And you know, it's not much different. You get a translator and you listen to what they have to say in Egypt or Poland or South America or wherever. The stories are about the same. It's certainly not every individual abductee who has even claim or any knowledge that they might have an implant, but the stories of the abduction situation are relatively the same. I mean,
really, is there almost a generic abduction story? It is interesting that you've been in all those different countries, and they're very similar. If you were to tell a generic story made up from all you've heard, what would the abduction be like?
Someone is taken without their permission. Sometimes there's memory, sometimes there's little memory, sometimes there's no memory. And they're taken someplace where they don't know where they are. And the ones with the conscious memories have experiences of, I guess you best put it, as medical experimentation. In the most cases, having something to do with ovum or a sperm. And it goes on from there to all the subjects of seeing what they believe are hybrid offspring and descriptions of beings. Sort of universally, it's the gray, but not in every case. Some have memories of, I'm talking about conscious memory, not
yes.
through regressive hypnosis. But, you know, some see people that look like us, you know, taller, blonde, blue eyes, good-looking. Other people see reptoid beings. Other people see insectoid beings. And then there's a myriad of others, you know, looking at things, for example, in the Middle East, where little old ladies on kibbutzes were describing craft coming down with you know, 8-9 foot tall beings coming out of it and gathering potatoes out of a field. Similar things seen in what was previously the Soviet Union. You don't see that in South America.
Doctor, is there any big difference between what people are able, some of the best people who have good conscious memories of what happened to them, versus those who, for example, went through hypnotic progression. Is there a big difference in what they remember?
Well, hypnotic regression done in the hands of a qualified, experienced hypnotherapist, and there's not many of them around anymore. Certainly John Mack had his share, and you know, we have Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, and fortunately in Southern California we have Yvonne Smith, and then in the other countries there's a few others. But there's not that many people who have, you know, the qualifications that these people have. But the hypnotic regression, I believe, only polishes details of the memory. Now, I think if everything is done right and according to what is supposed to happen, you're not supposed to remember anything. You just go through life and you're as happy as a clam. But unfortunately, I think there's been changes in the last maybe 20 or 30 years. People have, they develop phobias, and, you know, kids are afraid of clowns, and kids will go to a dentist where you're normally not afraid to be examined by a doctor, but they sit in a dental chair, and the minute the nurse brings the light over their face, they freak out. Well, some of these kids have had abduction experiences. So I think regressive hypnosis only polishes what's there somewhere in the conscious memory. Now, I do have someone that I met within the last year who is a very well-known person and very influential, has had an experience, and he has almost total recall of what went on. And he said that he begged them not to erase his memory because he had no fear. And he said he had no fear of them, and he didn't know, you know, why they were doing what they were doing. And he claims that they, and these were the Greys, that they told him that he was unique and that they did do experimentations and had a great knowledge about the human anatomy and physiology, and that they weren't going to do anything to him because he was a very unique soul. And the reason he gave them was one of the ones was he absolutely had no fear of them whatsoever. And then there was a few other things. For example, he said, you know, you're one of the few humans that we've ever picked up that was trying to tell us a joke, which we don't understand.
That's absolutely amazing. And last week I had a guest on the show, Dr. Lear, who said that people who are normally abducted are given screen memories. In other words, everything's blocked out, and they're given this sort of warm, fuzzy people, you had a wonderful experience, this screen memory that has to be penetrated to get to the real story. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think in some cases that's true. If they feel you're probably a person that might have a memory and then can't get along with it. Yeah, I hate to say this, especially on the air with a worldwide audience, but I have severe doubts that there's such a thing as the military abduction going on. I've looked into these cases, and you know what I found is that when someone reports military abductions, there's two things that stand out. Number one, they live very, very close to a military installation. Or number two, the whole family is just filled with people that are in the military. Now, these entities seem to be able to tap into your consciousness, and they know what's believable to you and what's not. You know, so if you believe that, you know, you have 30 relatives in your family that are military officers, I think what's acceptable to that particular person is giving them a nice memory that they're underground in some base with, you know, generals running around. On the other hand, you know, kids, sometimes they see clowns and owls and animals and things. So, and I think in some cases that's, you know, probably a good scenario, but certainly not in every case. And certainly people like this friend of mine now has become quite a good friend with, you know, a conscious memory that he has. I mean, it's right down to the nitty-gritty. And like I was saying, he was telling him a joke, and he says, well, if you don't understand what I'm telling you, then how could you tell I'm telling you a joke? And he said they told him, because you were laughing.
Is this a name we would know?
No. No, it's possible I could get him to come on the air if he didn't use his real name, but it wasn't too long ago. He had another event that occurred driving through Death Valley, California, and this one he was with his driver, and they
All right,
both
hold
went
that
through
story.
it.
Hold that story. We're at the bottom of the hour, so hold tight, Dr. Lear, and we'll come right back to gee, Death Valley, that's near home. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. It is indeed. My guest is Dr. Roger Lear. He is a podiatrist. Now, that's a doctor who basically takes care of your feet. That's what he does for a living. But somewhere along the way, he became interested in ufology. And then he became interested in helping people out who thought they had things implanted in them, various places. Then he became interested in surgery to remove these and having them analyzed. In other words, hard proof. And a lot, apparently, of what's been analyzed, or at least some of what's been analyzed, has come back showing that it has properties similar to that of a meteorite, which would mean things not normally found here on Earth. They can do an analysis of material. And if it is not from Earth and it's found inside a human being, at the very least, that has to make you go, So back to Dr. Lear, a story about the Death Valley area in a moment. Death Valley is very, very close to my homes in the desert, and so back now to Dr. Lear. Dr. Lear, you're about to say or tell us about a case, a friend of yours in the Death Valley area. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. He had been traveling through the Death Valley area since he was 16 years of age. He's now 83, and he has a driver. They take a shortcut from Death Valley to go to Tonopah by going through Beatty. Do you know where that cutoff
Oh,
is?
I absolutely do. Yes.
Okay, well, they've gone that route, he told me, hundreds and hundreds of times, and they could have done it backwards, upside down, and asleep. Well, this one particular night, they were driving along and looking, for the cutoff, chatting and so on, and they didn't see it. So they kept on going. Finally, they realized, we passed this. But he said to his driver, you haven't seen, Death Valley, Scotty's Castle, and up in that direction, and so on. And I guess, we could go that way. But let's turn around and go back. So they did. Well, they turned around, went back, and they went back and forth about a half a dozen times until they were convinced that maybe the state closed that road for some reason. And
Yes.
he said, "Well, Dennis, let's just go out the other way, and we can, come down from the north and go. We'll skip going to Beatty, and we'll just come down into Tonopah." So they had already made up their mind that's what they were going to do, and they're driving along, and in the near distance, they saw an aura of lights. And he said to Dennis, he said, "What, my gosh, what are those lights? There's not supposed to be any lights out here." And he said, in a few minutes, there came to a sign that said Beatty. Both, and I've interviewed them both. They both tell exactly the same story. But as I said, he had a history of this happening, and I've introduced him to Bud. Bud will be in California in December for the Norfolk Conference in San Diego, which should be a good one, I should mention. David Jacobs will be there, and Bud Hopkins, and myself, and a few other people. And one of the major topics, of course, is alien abduction. And it'll be in San Diego. I think it's the 2nd and 3rd of December. So I think we're going to get these two together. And he's willing to undergo a hypnotic session and learn more. And Bud talked to him on the phone, and evidently he's had things been going on since childhood. But here's a case of, you know, a conscious memory. Nothing fuzzy, just tells it as he remembers it.
Sure. Listen, the website, ballyhoos the fact that you had a recent visit to Area 51 during war game exercises. Now, that's incredible. Did you really get to Area 51?
Ooh, that's not warm and fuzzy. I had been to Area 51 numerous times before. Little alien mailbox.
That's the area. Well, yeah, the mailbox. Anybody can do that. That's on the highway. But when you say Area 51, I thought, boy, this guy has somehow managed to actually get a tour of and actually gone into Area 51 or what?
No. If I'd have been in Area 51, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
That's what I thought.
They would have erased me, not my memory.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I heard about them having their war games, which they call Red Flag Days.
That's right.
And I thought to myself, you know, if there is something to see, it would be a good time to fly it. So, you know, they just can't fly it over the Nellis Range or Papoose Lake. You know, they got to fly it somewhere. So maybe we'll see something unusual. And besides, kind of nice to get away. And as you know, the desert is so clear, and you can see the sky at night, and it's just marvelous. So anyway, we were well outfitted. But when I tell you the story, you'll see how absurd things can be. So we stayed at the little alien.
This was when, please?
This was about 3-4 weeks ago.
Okay, recently.
Yeah, recently. Right. There was four of us, and we drove out there and made a reservation. And we got there late on a Wednesday, and we knew that the temperatures get pretty cold at night, so we brought a lot of gear and gloves and thermoses so we could put hot chocolate and withstand the cold. And we staked out our little road off the extraterrestrial highway, sort of in the boonies there. And as you know, there's not much traffic there to begin with.
Right.
Interestingly enough, there were three Belgian pilots that were staying there also.
Really?
And they were going to fly the following week. And when they were not flying, they weren't on the base, so they didn't require them to stay there. But they were in constant communication with the satellite phones that they had. So we had some interesting conversations with them also, spoke very good English. But we went out the first night, as I said, with all the gear, and we decided where we were going to go. So we went off on this dirt road, and we got our chairs, and we watched the war games going on at night, which was quite interesting because the jets, the F-16s, fly in formation, and they do various aerial maneuvers, and you can see them strobing, and the afterburners are on constantly. I mean, they're just zipping all over the sky, and they're dropping flares, and all this stuff is going on. But we didn't see anything other than that. The next day, you can't really see much during the day, but evidently they drop bombs. And when you feel one of these things go off, it's like something I never felt before. I was in the Army, but I never felt anything like this. It was a double shock wave, a lot like what you experience when you hear the shuttle come in.
Right.
But it reverberates in the ground. I mean, it just shakes you to pieces. So I don't know, what kind of a bomb they're dropping. But that was kind of interesting. And as I said, you can when the air temperature at altitude is cold enough, and I don't know whether you know this or not, but when I quit flying, I had about 2,700 hours of airtime, and they have to be at a certain altitude to get a contrail because the air is cold.
That's right.
So you were able to see some of that, but you didn't see a great deal of anything. The following night, we said, okay, we're going to get out there before dark, and we'll get to where we were going and so on. And we got, for whatever the reason, the kind of a late start, we were chatting and so on. So it was already dark, and we were driving down this lonely road. And here's where it goes bananas. Around my neck is my binoculars, a real nice set of binoculars. And my lap is a Sony video cam with the night shot equipment.
I was going to ask if you took any night vision stuff.
Yeah, well, I had the camera, and it was there, I mean, ready to go, sitting on my lap, driving along, and I was sitting in the back, and two other people, one driving in the front, and the fellow that's driving, as we're cruising down this dirt road, says, oh, look, there's a light on that hill. And I said, oh, where? So we look, and yeah, there's a light on a hill, which wasn't there before. And then we slowed down a little bit, and there was two lights. And then there was three lights.
Uh-huh.
And then four lights. And then five. And then six. And then pretty soon, the lights, you could see, were going around in a circle counterclockwise.
Wow.
So I said, wow. And I pick up the video camera, and by the time I... it's so dark that when you turn on the viewfinder, it about blinds you. And by the time I got the viewfinder, to look at the light, it was already going back down where it came. Now, if we had had a lick of sense, which we didn't, not at all, official UFO, investigators.
Yeah.
Camera in my lap, binoculars. We should have just stopped, turned off the lights.
Of course.
And taking some pictures. But no,
look,
no,
though,
we had to get closer.
I don't fault you.
We had to get better.
I don't fault you for one second. almost nobody who sees these incredible things has a camera handy and is able to get it focused and ready and take the pictures. It just doesn't happen. But you really saw that. You saw as many as what, seven lights?
There were six or seven lights. And as
rotating?
They were going around counterclockwise.
Wow, that's a wow.
Yeah, and, if we had stopped and shut off the lights, I think they saw us. And therefore, who expects to see a car out, in the desert on a dirt road, even in that area, and not maybe even a weird ufologist?
Were you close enough to draw the attention of guards?
No. No, but I'm sure they knew we were there. Because,
yeah, I'm sure they did.
This was no extraterrestrial craft. This was something that's ours, because they saw us, and we weren't supposed to see it. They went back down.
Yeah, but what do we have that we know about that rotates in the manner you described? Nothing.
Well, we know absolutely nothing, but my God, they don't even tell us that the aurora exists, and that was on the pages, 15 years ago of,
sure.
Of the magazines with the propulsion system.
That's right.
So they're not going to tell us we got that kind of equipment, but
I hope
tell
you guys
the rest of the story.
Okay, go ahead.
The rest of the story. The following night, we were out, and we were getting ready to leave. We were still at the little alien, and boy, the activity was just spectacular. They were dropping flares and targets, and the F-16s were just all over the place. And so we stopped as we were, heading out to the car, virtually stopped, and we were looking at things through the binoculars and so on. And we saw what we thought were... three F-16s flying in formation, two ahead and one trailing, and then another one sort of off to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys exclaimed, gee, that's weird. What's weird? What are you talking about? Well, that big bright star that was just ahead of those two F-16s, it just disappeared. So I said, oh, really? So I trained my binoculars up there. And there was this whole patch where you could not see the stars, and it was in the shape of a triangle.
Oh.
And the one to the left that was trailing was an F-16. And what we thought were F-16s, which was the strobing, was on each edge of the triangle.
Oh, you saw exactly what I've seen. I got to see it a whole lot closer. But there's no question about it. We have, or they have, or somebody has, a triangle that defies gravity. And if it doesn't defy gravity, then it's a lighter-than-air craft of some sort. But what I saw looked very metallic, very silent, completely silent. I mean, we have it. Either we have it, or they have it, or we back-engineered it, or something. But these triangles are as real as a heart attack.
No, absolutely. This thing was just blocking, and it was huge. I mean, they were at the same height, as far as the lights were concerned, as what the F-16s were flying. And that altitude, you know, had to be above 30,000 feet. And this thing blocked out a chunk of the stars. You just couldn't see through it, you know. But I didn't see the detail that...
But there were enough stars so that you could actually make out the outline of what was blocked.
Oh, yeah. You know, then we realized these are not three F-16s. This is a triangle. And as it's moving along... Yeah, and with all the noise from the other guys with their afterburners on, there was no excess noise from this thing, so I would assume it's silent. But again, four of us saw it. We all looked through the binoculars and were absolutely flabbergasted. And as I said, there was these three Belgian pilots there, and the day that we were leaving, two of them were outside talking on their satellite phones, and I was inside with one of them. We were sort of saying goodbye. We got to know them pretty well. And I said, well, you know, we didn't really waste anything coming here because we saw some interesting things. So what'd you see? So I told him, and he was kneeling down on the floor by the table where I was sitting, and he just smiled. He says, well, you know, all the things you hear about Area 51, yes. Well, they're all true.
Well, coincidentally, Belgium is a place that has had I don't know how many sightings, tons of them, of these triangular craft, as I'm sure you're aware.
Oh yes, and he knew about them. Yes, indeed. I said, you know, I'm just wondering how many countries have this exchange program with Area 51 where they participate in these games. And he says, well, I really don't know. And I said, well, I bet you don't see the French Air Force over here. And he just busted out laughing. He says, you will never see the French Air Force here.
Yes, I'm sure not. Boy, isn't that fascinating. So he admitted, he virtually admitted it to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's
all true.
Away,
the stories you hear are all true. Oh, my God.
They're all true, he says.
God, I would so love to know about this. I really would. Well, so congratulations. You had the experience. I'm sure what you just told is going to cause a lot of people to go camp out by that mailbox. Listen, while we're at it, why don't you tell them, a lot of people want to know, if you want to try and observe for yourself, where exactly do you go?
Well, extraterrestrial highway, easy to find. Little alien, you get on the extraterrestrial highway, and you can go in either direction. There are dirt roads that head off towards the base. Don't go too far, because you'll come to a gate. Don't go past the gate, or you won't be around anymore. So if you want to take a chance and go down that road, you can see really good from there, or you can go in the opposite direction. Now, there's one more thing I got to tell you. The following day, during the day, we took off on that road because the day that we saw this saucer-shaped thing, we wanted to see, you know, what kind of a weird hill is this anyway? You know, what's behind it? Where could that thing have gone?
Right.
So we didn't have a four-wheel drive, but we took the car and we drove as far as we could down this road. And this I did video. And we came across the weirdest set of telephone poles that I've ever seen. They were all high-tension lines. And on the bottom set of wires were, you know, the look like telephone lines. But as we got closer to the edge of this mountain, about every third pole, one of these telephone or communications lines went down the pole and into the ground.
Boy, isn't that odd?
Yeah, really, really weird. So maybe, just maybe, the extent of the underground portion of that base comes, way out farther than the restricted area that you're not allowed into.
Dr. Lear, there are a lot of people who think that Area 51 has been abandoned when it comes to these secret projects that we're now talking about and moved up into Utah or to another location. Obviously, that's not entirely so.
No, I mean, that's not, can't be because, you know, they have more than one place where they have this secret stuff, but you're not going to spend that kind of money on that kind of a base. And
on top of that, they annexed a lot more land recently, and that can't be for nothing as well. Dr. Lear, hold tight. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be back shortly. Dr. Roger Lear, I'm Art Bell in Manila, the Philippines.